Hey, Mason. It's Thursday, July 9th, 2026, and we've got a full plate for you on the drive-in.
Full plate, or just a lot of tabs open again?
A little of both, honestly. First up, a quick radar pass over the newest research we've actually kept, the stuff that survived the cutting room floor this week.
Which, by our usual ratio, was maybe a third of what came in.
Exactly why it's worth hearing. Then, we roll into the weekly roundup on native language tech, what's moving across tribal and community projects right now.
Good, I want to hear if anyone else is wrestling with the same data problems we are.
Let's start with the radar. The research radar picked up a real cluster this week, and a lot of it lands close to home.
Start with the retrieval piece, since that's the one closest to what Mason's actually building.
Right, there's a new paper on retrieval augmented generation for public health question answering, and it's less about a flashy result and more a careful audit of how you evaluate a RAG pipeline in the first place.
Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning they test different retrieval configurations and score them not just on whether the answer sounds right, but on faithfulness. Does the generated answer actually trace back to the retrieved passage, or is the model quietly drifting off on its own?
That's the exact failure mode that matters for a language model grounded in community-approved Lakota texts. If it can't show its work back to the sourcebook, it shouldn't be trusted.
Exactly, and having a public health domain do this rigorously gives a template for per-stage evaluation outside the usual big language benchmarks.
Okay, second cluster, the cultural side.
There's a paper reframing Indic language AI through a cultural heritage preservation lens rather than a pure benchmark lens. It's arguing that for underrepresented languages, the goal isn't just accuracy, it's whether the technology respects and sustains the culture it's drawing from.
That's basically the sovereignty argument Mason's already living inside, just coming from a completely different language family.
Which is worth noting on its own, independent research communities converging on the same conclusion, that community governance has to be part of the technical design, not bolted on after.
Good corroboration, even if it's not new to him.
Then there's a cluster of more technical, low-resource transfer papers. One is a large study on multilingual reasoning, and the interesting finding is that having a model reason in English first, then answer, actually boosts its accuracy on multiple-choice questions in low-resource languages.
That's a data efficiency trick, basically. Borrow reasoning capacity from a high-resource language instead of needing thousands of examples in the target one.
Which matters directly for adapting models to a language with a small text corpus. Related to that, there's a speech recognition paper doing cross-lingual transfer from Sinhala to Dvi, different languages, similar idea, using a related, better-resourced language as a stepping stone.
Any of these actually transfer in method, or just in concept?
Mostly in concept and technique, the specific language pairs won't map over, but the transfer learning recipe is the reusable part. Two more worth a quick mention. One extends math reasoning evaluation to underrepresented languages, exposing how much benchmark coverage skips non-English math entirely.
And the other?
A paper on Mongolian, written in its traditional vertical script, tackling the ambiguity that comes from a language rendered in two different writing systems.
That's actually a nice parallel. Orthography choices distorting a low-resource language's usable data, which is its own open question for Lakota texts with inconsistent historical spelling systems.
A quieter theme than usual, but a coherent one. Evaluation rigor, cultural framing, and transfer tricks, all pointing the same direction. Let's do the roundup, because this week gives us almost a controlled experiment in who gets to control language technology and who doesn't.
Start with the win, then.
Fine. Google Maps in New Zealand just rolled out a new voice that actually pronounces Te Reo Māori place names correctly, after years of people complaining that the app was butchering city and town names.
How'd they get the pronunciation right, though? That's usually where these things fall apart.
They didn't do it alone. Google partnered with the Māori Language Commission, and the voice was trained on a real Kiwi speaker over roughly 6 months. The commission's chief executive, Ngahi Hui Apanui Bar, called it a step toward securing the language's future in the digital age.
6 months for one voice model is not nothing, but I want to flag what's still just announced versus what's actually shipped. It's rolling out over 2 weeks, and that's only for cities and towns. Streets and roads are, quote, planned for a future update.
Right, so the safe read is partial win, real partnership, timeline still open-ended.
And notice who held the pen. Google built the model. The commission was the approval and quality gate, not the developer. That's better than nothing, a lot better than nothing, but it's still a corporation deciding when the update happens and what the roadmap looks like.
Which is exactly the tension our listener lives inside every day. Compare it to the second story this week, which is almost the opposite shape. A Navajo man named George Joe spent 3 years on his own building an app called Tribal Trails.
What does it do?
It's a GPS-triggered audio tour. You're driving a route like Gallup to Flagstaff or Flagstaff to Phoenix, and as you cross into different areas, the app narrates the actual cultural and historical context of Navajo, Zuni, and Acoma land and landmarks instead of whatever tourist brochure version you'd otherwise get.
So no corporate partner, no commission, no six-month training run. Just one person deciding what gets said about his own homeland.
Exactly. He's already in phase two, adding segments for Albuquerque and Santa Fe. It's small, it's not AI flashy the way a text-to-speech model is, but it's total control over the narrative layer. Nobody has to approve what he says about Navajo land.
That's the trade-off in miniature, isn't it? The Google deal gets you Google's reach and Google's engineering budget, but you're a stakeholder in someone else's system. Joe's app gets him full authorship, but he's doing 3 years of unpaid labor, and he doesn't have Google's distribution.
And that's basically the whole debate this week, just phrased two different ways in two different pieces. One came out of Australia, timed to 50 years of a major national Indigenous observance week there, arguing that artificial intelligence risks becoming just another extractive force against Indigenous knowledge unless it's built on consent, credit, and return.
Extractive how, specifically? I don't want to just nod along with a vibe.
The piece points to something concrete as a counterexample. Aboriginal medical clinics in regional Western Australia trialing AI-assisted screening for diabetic eye disease. That's framed as AI done well, because it's a tool serving an existing community health relationship, not a company mining community data to train something it then owns.
Okay, that's a real example, but it's also a completely different domain from language work. Detecting a disease in a retina scan doesn't carry the same stakes as who gets to speak for a language.
Fair, and the piece knows that, which is why its actual policy ask is broader. Treat Indigenous data sovereignty, the ownership, control, access, and possession framework, sometimes shortened to the OCAP principles, alongside the related care principles, as mandatory foundations for any AI project touching Indigenous knowledge. Not an ethics add-on you bolt on at the end.
Mandatory according to whom, though? That's the part these op-eds always gesture past. Who enforces it?
Which is the exact question the next piece tries to answer. This one's an analysis piece framing the whole AI moment as a three-way contest between state sovereignty, corporate sovereignty, and what it calls Indigenous techno-sovereignty.
Meaning traditional ideas of a nation-state controlling its own borders and laws don't really describe who controls an AI system.
Right, because the actual power sits in corporate-controlled infrastructure, cloud compute, model weights, training pipelines, regardless of what country you're standing in. And the piece's proof that a third path is possible is Tehiku Media's speech recognition model for Te Reo Māori, which it cites at 92% accuracy, plus a broader initiative called the First Languages AI Reality Project.
Tehiku Media I actually trust as an example, because that's a case our listener would recognize the shape of immediately. Community built, community owned. The data doesn't leave the community's control.
Which is the whole reason it gets cited as the flagship case. Everyone writing about Indigenous AI sovereignty points at the same one or two working examples, because there just aren't that many yet.
That's worth saying plainly. This is a commentary piece, not a new development. It's not announcing anything Tehiku Media did this week. It's using an existing already proven model to argue for a policy direction, federated architectures, data trusts, and permanent Indigenous seats at the table when AI standards get written.
Which sounds good, and also costs nothing to write down. The test is whether any standards body actually seats someone permanently, versus inviting a token speaker to one workshop.
And that skepticism is basically confirmed by the last story, which is the most sobering one this week. There was an online panel on July 6th, feeding into the United Nations Global Dialogue on AI Governance, looking specifically at South Asia.
What was the actual finding?
It's less a finding than an open question, honestly, and I want to be straight about that, because it's a discussion event, not a study with a result. But the question they raised is sharp. Are South Asian nations building real sovereign AI capacity, or a more polished version of dependency on the same handful of outside providers?
And where does Indigenous data fit into that specifically?
That's the part that should worry our listener most. The panel flagged that tribal communities' ecological knowledge, territorial records, oral traditions, are entering AI systems across borders with no clear accountable actor, nobody you could even name to hold responsible. And this is happening despite obligations these countries have under International Labor Organization Convention 169 and the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
So the law exists, on paper, and it's not stopping anything.
Right, and that's the through line for the whole week, actually. Every one of these stories is answering the same question with a different sample size. Who's the accountable actor when Indigenous language or knowledge goes into a system?
For Google Maps, the accountable actor is the Māori Language Commission, at least for approval, even if Google owns the model.
For tribal trails, it's literally one Navajo man, which means total accountability, but also total fragility. If he stops, the project stops.
For Tehiku Media, it's the community itself, start to finish, which is why it keeps getting cited as the model everyone else is reaching for and can't quite replicate.
And for the South Asia case, the honest answer is nobody. That's not a criticism of any one country, it's just what the panel was flagging, that the accountability gap is the default state, unless someone deliberately builds the fence around it.
Which is exactly the fence our listener is building. Community-approved source texts instead of scraped ones, per-stage evaluation instead of one black box output, and governance sitting with the community rather than with whoever hosts the compute.
That's the Tehiku Media shape, not the South Asia shape. And I think that's the actual lesson from putting these five stories side by side. The technology to pronounce a word correctly, or transcribe a sentence accurately, or narrate a landmark honestly. That part is genuinely getting easier every year. Google's new voice proves that. Tehiku Media's accuracy number proves that.
The part that isn't getting easier is the governance question underneath it. Who approved the training data? Who owns what comes out? Who can say no?
And nothing this week says that gets solved by better models. It gets solved by who's holding the pen when the project starts, not after.
So that's the roundup, a map update teaching better pronunciation, an app turning a phone into a guide for routes that already had names before they were highways, and two papers arguing sovereignty has to mean building the systems, not just being consulted on them.
The through line for me is control. Who holds the language data? Who holds the compute? Who gets a seat versus who gets a switch to flip?
Exactly. That's the tension worth sitting with this week. Thanks for listening, Mason. We'll be back with the next batch soon.